You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Romanov dynasty ruled an ever-expanding Russian empire that grew over three centuries to cover one-sixth of the Earth's surface. Simon Sebag Montefiore's most recent book, The Romanovs, intimately details the lives and courts of the 20 czars and czarinas over that time, giving us a portrait of the family that turned a war-ravaged principality into one of Europe's most powerful states. Mr. Montefiore is a historian of Russia and the Middle East, and his previous books include Catherine the Great and Potemkin and Jerusalem, the biography. I spoke to him back in May, and we're rebroadcasting that interview for you now. I began our conversation by asking him, 300 years is a long time for one family to stay in power. Why was the Romanov dynasty so stable?
Well, I mean, the success of the Russian Empire was really a combination of an alliance between the Romanov family, the nobility, the army, and the Russian spirit, if you like, of expansion. And empire building was always in the Romanov bloodstream.
How much did it grow during their 300 years?
Oh, it increased vastly. Every year it increased something like sort of 55 square miles a day or something, to Siberia, into Poland, into Finland, and of course to the south, into Ukraine, Crimea.
But hadn't that actually started earlier, before the Romanovs? Because I remember Ivan the Terrible, the Eisenstein film, there the soldiers are going to Kazan to conquer.
Right. That's right. I mean, Ivan the Terrible really started it. He took Kazan, Astrakhan, and then it went, and also started the expansion into Siberia, which was just the most colossal thing. But ultimately, you know, you think of the Romanov family, we so often hear of them as a kind of, one thinks of them in the sort of Hollywood mythology as a kind of cursed dynasty. In some senses, they were. I mean, six out of the last 12 czars were murdered. And yet, they were certainly the most successful dynasty of modern times.
You open the book with a comparison between the first of them, Michael Romanov, and the last heir, Alexei. Were their stories similar at all?
Well, you know, this is
and part, you say Michael, not Mikhail?
Yeah. Mikhail, Michael. In the book, I make the decision all the way through to use the name that is most easy for the reader. I mean, I love to write books that are sort of based on scholastic and academic research and new archives, but I want them to be readable for everybody. So you can read this as a study of Russia, a study of power universally, or you can just read it as an entertainment. And it's an amazing story, this family. A family where fathers kill their own sons, where sons kill their own fathers, where wives, kill their husbands and overthrow them. So it begins with these
and
two sons.
And women become the rulers.
And women become the rulers. And there's a whole century where a succession of amazing women. And this is so extraordinary if you think that even today Russia's probably the most chauvinistic and unfeminist country in Europe. And yet for a century, a succession of amazing women, some of them dark, evil, and cruel. Some of them kind of brutal monsters straight out of Game of Thrones, and other of them, the most humane and brilliant statesmen of modern times, ruled Russia.
Well, there's a lot of violence in the story, but you talked about your research. I've heard stories from other historians that when they've asked to see sensitive material, especially from the Soviet years, something that they had seen at an archive the day before was suddenly no longer in the folder. Were your Russian sources helpful
putting this
book together?
Well, I've been in and out with the Kremlin. With my first book, Catherine the Great and Potemkin, no one wanted me to write it. On the first day in the archives, the archivist refused to show me anything.
And why?
Because
after all, it's ancient history in a way.
Because they were protecting stuff that they wanted to put out, publish probably, but also they were protecting the morals of Catherine the Great. And when I sat down and to start work, there was a terrible squealing from the gallery above me, and a kitten landed on my head. And I looked up, and there was the archivist waving at me, warning me that she was in control. But after that, I got access to the Stalin archives, because they were so pleased that my Catherine and Potemkin had rehabilitated two Russians, great Russian statesmen. They hated the Stalin, the Court of the Red Tsar book, which I published. And so when I went back into the archives, having been the favorite child of the Russian archives, they all denied ever knowing me and claimed that I'd never given them presents, and, I had no more privileges. So now I have no privileges, but I did found amazing new stuff in the archives for this book.
Well, how much is the story of the Romanovs in the early years in the public record? For example, Michael and his mother didn't want the throne.
Well, that's fascinating. I think there are lots of things in this book that will surprise readers. But the most interesting is that Michael was chosen almost because he was weak, nondescript, sickly, but innocent and connected to the dynasty of Ivan the Terrible. But when he was offered the throne...
Ivan wasn't a Romanov.
Ivan was not. He was a Rurikid. But he'd killed his own son as well. I mean, other czars did that too. Peter the Great did that. We might discuss that. But so they were looking for someone with a connection to the old dynasty, but someone fresh and new and innocent. And so normally czars had to be majestic, terrifying, both field marshals, saints... prime ministers, they had to be everything, and only a genius could really fulfill the role. But in this case, in 1613, at the beginning of the dynasty, they kind of sprung it on this teenage boy of sickly health. And when he heard the offer, he burst into tears, and his mother, in a slightly Monty Python-ish way, started sort of saying, "How dare you offer him the throne?" But he accepted it, and out of these unlucky beginnings came the restoration of Russian power and autocracy.
Were they royalty, Romanovs?
They were connected to royalty because the Romanovs really appeared...
But they weren't next in line.
They weren't. Well, there was no line anymore. I mean, the family was extinct. And Russia was a failed state invaded by the Swedes, the Poles, the Tartars. It was no one wanted to be Tsar by that point. So many Tsars had been killed. And out of it came this election of Michael.
And what about the word Tsar? That comes out of the word Caesar?
That's right. Kaiser, Caesar, Tsar are all the same word, Kaiser being the German for emperor. And they quite self-consciously based themselves on the Caesars. And, of course, when they made themselves emperors as well, the Russian word is imperator. So they kind of went even more Roman.
You mentioned that 1613, when Michael ascended to the throne, was a bad time. It was known as the terrible time.
Yeah, the time of troubles. And it was a time when Russia just was disintegrating from every side. It seemed like Russia might fail to become a state. Maybe we'd be talking about Poland now. Poland could have become, or Sweden could have become, the ruler of that vast Eurasian space.
So what happened? Michael actually surprised everybody?
Michael remains a bit of a non-entity, but Michael and the warlords around him and the top boyars restored power. And this is a pattern that we have in Russian history, in modern Russian history, again and again. And it's relevant today because in 1610 to 1613, Russia disintegrates. They elect, in a kind of pretty open election, they elect this boy to be Tsar. And within a few years, he's restored hard-line Tsarist autocracy. And the same thing happens in 1917, 1918, chaos, democratic elections, and you get Lenin and Stalin. And in the 90s, Yeltsin, chaos, and now we have one man rule again, the ultimate autocrat, Vladimir Putin.
So history repeats itself in Russian history we don't see pretty much anywhere else.
It doesn't quite repeat itself, but of course Putin is not copying the Tsars per se, just as he's not copying Stalin, but he's channeling both. And I think the result is something that's quite unique, but it's also a hybrid of those two earlier periods.
My guest is Simon Sebag Montefiore. His latest book is The Romanovs, 1613 to 1918. It's published by Knopf, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with a rebroadcast of a conversation I had with Simon Sebag Montefiore, a noted historian of Russia and the Middle East. He was on our show last May to discuss his latest book, The Romanovs, 1613 to 1918. If you heard the first part of our conversation, you've probably gathered that this book is full of so many good stories and information that there just wasn't enough time to cover it all. But I did think it was important to talk about the relationship between the Tsar and the patriarchs of the Orthodox Church.
Well, that's a fascinating subject.
I mean, there were other religions in the country.
Well, the empire was a multinational. You know, there were Jews, there were Catholics. The Jews were most important. And in fact, you know, one of the themes of the book is the kind of Romanov fetish, anti-Semitism. But that's another subject. You asked about the church. The church started off with the patriarch being, you know, almost as important as the Tsar, sometimes more important. But Peter the Great changed all that. He made the patriarchate, the church, into a branch of the government. And it was not really restored until 1943, when a student for the priesthood, Joseph Stalin, restored it. Now, interestingly, under President Putin, there is a patriarch again, but it's really, again, a branch of the presidency, a branch of the autocracy. And at the moment, they are actually looking into the bodies of the Romanovs. Again, they're exhuming them and testing them for DNA in order to bury the last two unburied children of that massacre in 1918, which, of course, is just an example of how the church is a branch of the presidency.
So Jews, Muslims, Catholics were not, other minorities weren't treated well. What about the peasants and the merchant class?
Well, one of the themes of the book is the fact, is the conflict that all the Tsars faced between being emperors of this multinational empire, a multinational, multiple religion empire with all these talented minorities like Georgians and Jews and Poles, and being a Russian Tsar, being Russian Slavophile Orthodox Tsar. And they couldn't quite work out how to balance this. And in the end, the last Tsars, Alexander III especially, and Nicholas II, made it purely Russian and persecuted all the minorities, which was disastrously stupid. I mean, the anti-Semitism, which was so obsessional in the family. Nicholas II was the most virulent anti-Semite. Even in exile, even in imprisonment after he'd been overthrown, he was reading his daughters, not just Tolstoy, but he was reading them the Protocols of the Elders of Zion at night to put them to sleep. So that gives you an idea.
One of the stories that I totally I've learned from this that I find fascinating is about the bride shows.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, they chose their wives in a kind of cross between the X Factor, The Voice, and Miss World. And like all these kind of spectacular shows to choose a winner, they were kind of fixed. The results were kind of fixed. And that was how everyone up until Peter the Great chose their wives in these kind of bizarre ritualistic shows.
They would have a kind of a bunch of women would be sent in, and then they would be winowed out to a smaller group.
That's right.
What happened to the losers?
Well, the losers just went home. That was fine. More tragic is the ones who won and then were poisoned by a faction at court with an emetic or a diuretic.
So why were they poisoned?
Well, because, you know, the arrival of a new wife would always inevitably change the balance of power at court. And so the losing faction, if you like, would often poison the fiancés, and then they had to be sent back to Siberia.
Could somebody decline, say, I'd rather not be part of the selection?
Absolutely not. That would be unthinkable.
Interestingly, we mentioned earlier women became czars. Who was the first woman ruler in the Romanov dynasty, and how did she gain power?
Well, that's one of the fascinating questions. The first one in her own right was Catherine the First. She just sums up the power of autocracy, the power of the autocrat in Russia, which we see today with the oligarchs, for example, in Putin and Yeltsin's Russia. The state, the autocrat, can make people, they can break people, they can raise people from nothing to everything. So, you know, Catherine I was neither Russian nor a noblewoman. She was pretty much a prostitute, or, you know, she'd been the mistress of various generals and henchmen of Peter the Great. She was his laundress. He fell in love with her. She became his mistress. And then he married her and then crowned her Empress of all the Russias, which is the most meteoric rise of anyone in modern history. Forget Napoleon. And she succeeded him as Empress in her own right.
Was she good? Was she a good ruler?
Not really. She could outdrink Peter the Great. And that was one of her attractions, was that she was completely unshockable. Her letters to Peter the Great often said, you know, enjoy your mistress's come over, I want to make another baby with you, but don't bring that VD that you caught, don't bring that gonorrhea you caught with that French hooker you're with now. So, you know, partly of this book is based on many state documents, but a lot of it is based on intimate love letters and correspondences like that.
Now, we shouldn't confuse Catherine the First with Catherine the Great, who also was not Russian.
That's right. I mean, she was at least kind of royal. I mean, she was a German princess. She made herself the Russian candidate for the throne. And with her, you really have one of the most supremely intelligent and fascinating characters in the book. And I find I'm very fond of her, actually.
When did the Tsars assume the title emperor?
Well, Peter the Great assumed it after, in the early 1720s.
Now, judging from the stories you tell here, he was anything but great. He should have been called Peter the Terrible.
He
was incredibly violent. You tell a story about a woman who was accused of having abortions, committing infanticide, and stealing, and he had her beheaded?
She'd been his mistress, and she was the most beautiful woman at court. She was called Mary Hamilton. She was Scottish. And he walked with her to the execution. He held her hand, whispered to her, and everyone thought she'd be pardoned. But instead, her head was chopped off, and he lifted up the head and said to the Russian crowd, I'm going to give you an anatomy lesson. Here's the windpipe. Here's the spinal column. He then kissed the head on the lips, and it was the most beautiful head anyone had ever seen, by the way. And she was only about 21. And then he just dropped the head in the basket and said, I'm off to work.
Was he called the Great because of the impact he had on the country, Europeanizing it?
He was the
first czar to actually travel through Europe?
Yes, he was the first czar to travel through Europe. He was really fascinated by Western technology, which he wanted to use, in effect, against the West to make Russia a great power. And he succeeded in doing this. So his obsessions were really artillery and ships.
But he also kept giants and dwarfs to entertain him.
Well, he had these wild orgies where which was really the kind of Russian government at play, where you had dwarf tossing, fights, naked girls jumping out of pies. There was something of kind of Led Zeppelin on tour in the 70s, crossed with Stalin's terrifying nocturnal banquets. It was really about fun for Peter the Great, but also a way of him exerting power over his henchmen.
But he also reformed the Russian government.
Yes, I mean, he was a brilliantly talented statesman. I mean, you have to say he's half monster, half genius. He was one of those rare statesmen who could not only knew what he wanted to do, but could do it. And by the time he died, Russia controlled Poland, had troops in Germany, controlled the Baltic, had a Baltic fleet, and had founded Petersburg.
How did you find out about the orgies and those things? Were they reported upon at the time?
Yeah, they were reported by, I mean, a lot of foreign diplomats were at them. But terrible things happened at these orgies. I mean, in one case, one rival politician ruffled the hair of his rival, who then stabbed him in the neck with a fork. I mean, Peter the Great often ended up in a fight with people and would punch them in the face or try and kill them. I mean, but he alone and his henchman Menshikov had the sort of personal constitution to be able to drink all night and then get up in the morning and work.
What about his heir, Alexei? Was he similar in his approach to governing?
No, I mean, he wanted to undo everything that Peter had done, and Peter regarded him as a threat to all his achievements, and that's why he had him arrested, lured him back from where he'd escaped to Europe, and then tortured him to death systematically.
So Catherine the Great then took over the throne?
Catherine the First then took over the throne.
Catherine the First.
And then you have, because there were no heirs, there was then this century of women, and some of these women were pretty fascinating. I mean, the regent, for example, Anna Leopoldovna in 1740, was really ruling from a kind of lesbian ménage à trois. And I found letters that no one's used before that show how bizarre this ménage à trois was between her male lover and her female lover, and the fact that she tried to marry them to each other before she was overthrown by Elizaveta, the Russian Venus, the most beautiful of all the czars, something of an nymphomaniac. Peter the Great's amazing daughter, who was as tough as Peter the Great and really laid the foundations for Russian greatness that were later came to fruition under Catherine the Great.
And Catherine, like Peter, had many lovers. What were the benefits and dangers of being romantically entangled with a czar or a czarina?
Well, it could be very dangerous, but in Catherine the Great's case, there was no danger. She was incredibly generous to everybody. Usually, they played no role in politics at all, except to walk around three steps behind her, become incredibly rich. Obviously, they had to endure whatever lovemaking she wanted, but also she liked to teach them history and classics. She was very pedagogic. But it was only Prince Potemkin, really, who became her partner in ruling the Russian Empire.
A subject of a previous book of yours.
Yes.
How had her marriage ended?
Well, the marriage had not ended well, or begun well, for that matter. She on the 28th of June, 1762, she overthrew her husband, Peter III, who was a useless politician who defended every sector of Russian society. When he was overthrown, he was going to have to die. And her lover and supporters, the Orlov brothers, strangled him to death.
Then Catherine's relationship with her son Paul also soured.
Well, Paul was very like the.
Did anybody like anybody here?
No. I mean, the trouble is that in royal families, the necessity for the parents to die before the sons or daughters can rise to power means that there's a certain tension between the generations. And that's true of all royal families, of course.
Well, Emperor Paul's murder was particularly brutal. How many Romanovs were assassinated?
Well, 6 of the last 12 were killed, including of whom Paul's included. And fascinatingly, I found amazing materials in the French archives about the murder of Paul. He had whipped some noblemen in front of the whole army. And when it came to his overthrow, these three noblemen who'd been humiliated by him jumped on him and literally beat him and strangled him to death. And when he was dead, they stomped him with their boots. So that was a brutal assassination.
Would the revolution have been less likely to have occurred or succeeded if the late Romanovs had been more competent as rulers?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, my favorite of the later Romanovs is Alexander II, who negotiated the freeing of the serfs, and who was a very attractive character, quite unlike some of the ghastly militarist Germanic martinets.
And admired the United States.
Well, he admired the United States. He was corresponding with President Lincoln, another person who had also freed his own slaves in his own country, and who was also assassinated. Now, Alexander II realized in the end that he wanted to create a constitution, and he was assassinated before he could do that. But that was a huge mischance. And over again, we see in Russian history, as in all history, that the personality is hugely important. But I should say, Alexander II is also the star, if you like, of a correspondence that had not really been worked on before this book. And it's 3,000 letters corresponding with his mistress, Katya. And, I mean, these are wonderful letters. They're political, they're amorous, they're romantic. They're also the most sexually explicit correspondence I've ever heard of, and I think it's the most sexually explicit correspondence in all of human history, with the head of state involved. And I think anyone who reads them, the stuff in those letters that I thought hadn't been invented in the 19th century, I'm not going to tell you what that is. But
well, not on the air, anyway.
Not on the air, but the readers will readers will hopefully be able to guess what that is.
Now, was it all just about power struggles? What role did the military play in all of this?
The military were always super important. And in fact, from Peter the Great onwards, the first Romanovs were what I would call sacred autocrats. And after Peter the Great, they were overwhelmingly military autocrats. And they all wanted to be Peter the Great. They all wanted to command in battle like he had at Poltava when he defeated the Swedes. But actually, none of them could really do it. And none of them were talented militarily.
You write about the execution of the Romanovs following the Russian Revolution. Why did the Bolsheviks feel it was necessary to kill everyone, including the children? Well, couldn't they have just sent them off into exile?
Well, you know, that's the thing. I mean, they feared that they would become banners for the whites. But there's no explanation for it. It was just one of the most appalling crimes. And writing this story, I have to say, was absolutely heartbreaking for me. I literally wept as I wrote this story, and I think I challenge anyone to read it without weeping. The murder of these four girls and this little boy, as well as various servants and the family doctor and the parents. I think the parents expected to be executed at some point, and they were preparing for death in a rather noble fashion. But the children, no one would have thought that there could be such a flint-hearted regime as the communists, that they would kill the children.
But the last Tsar was kind of incompetent, wasn't he? Kind of like Louis XVI was in France?
I mean, he was worse than incompetent. I think we're very used to a romantic view of Nicholas and Alexandra as wonderful parents who were in love with each other and so on. In fact, they were worse than incompetent. They were duplicitous. they were fairly vicious to their enemies.
Sounds like it was in the genes.
They were savagely anti-Semitic in a way that I think will shock readers who were brought up on Robert Massey's wonderful and romantic account of Nicholas and Alexandra that was made into a film. I think people will be shocked by this view of Nicholas and Alexandra. And, you know, they were capable of great savagery, being extremely vicious. And also Alexandra was described as a woman of enormous stupidity and iron will, which is a terrible combination. And it was she that really trusted Rasputin and brought Rasputin into government with disastrous consequences for Russia.
Because Rasputin is one of the infamous figures of this time. But that was all, at least as the story is told, because the prince suffered from hemophilia.
Yeah, but I think what's new about in this book is that you'll see that, you know, it wasn't just the prince, Tsarevich Alexei, who needed Rasputin. Nicholas and Alexandra needed him just as much as this child did. And he became their confessor, their advisor, their consigliere, if you like, in a mafia family, which this sometimes resembles. And, you know, oftentimes his advice was good, but his personnel advice was absolutely catastrophic. And that was the tragedy.
And then he survived an attempted assassination, which just enhanced his sense of power.
Yes, but then it was in World War One that he really rose to sort of political power. And the amazing correspondence of Nicholas and Alexandra together show how important he was. Just when sort of Britain and France were fighting on the Western Front, Rasputin was really kind of running the government in Russia with disastrous consequences. And when Prince Yusupov and Grand Duke Dmitri decided to assassinate him, that assassination has been Hollywoodized and mythologized and made into a sort of vampire movie with a sort of star through the heart. In fact, the fascinating thing is much of that is rubbish. It was really an execution of an innocent peasant of great political influence. And he was really shot in the forehead at point-blank range and executed. And all of it achieved nothing because, in fact, it was Nicholas and Alexandra who was setting policy.
Just one more question. How are they perceived today in Russia?
Well, Nicholas and Alexandra are regarded by Putin himself as a disastrous czars. He ranks them, along with Gorbachev, as two of the most disastrous rulers of Russia had. While he admires Alexander I, Nicholas I, Peter the Great, and Stalin as great czars. So he regards things not ideologically, but in terms of success and Russian imperial triumph.
Simon Sebag Montefiore has written a number of books on Russia and also the Middle East. He's been translated into 40 languages. His latest, The Romanovs, 1613 to 1918, is published in this country by Knopf. And I thank you so much for being on our show again.
Lovely to be here. Great to see you.